Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the debate over President Trump's new tax plan. Many Republicans love it.
Tax reform is long overdue. We are going to cut taxes for businesses to make them competitive, and we're going to cut taxes for the American people, especially low and middle income families.
Democrats disagree.
I have never seen a tax plan that does more harm to the middle class and more to boost those at the top than the outline released yesterday.
It's all part of our Week in Review. Also today, the Boston Independent Film Festival continues this weekend. We'll talk to the team behind the documentary Stumped. It's about a Boston filmmaker who lost both his arms and legs to a deadly infection.
I went into the hospital and said to my friend, I'll see you at the noon meeting, Bob. And that turned out to be the last time I walked on my own two feet.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Happy Friday, everyone. Let's dive straight into our Week in Review, beginning with President Trump's new tax plan. It was heralded by Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin.
This is going to be the biggest tax cut and the largest tax reform in the history of our country. And we are committed to seeing this through.
However, it was lambasted by Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
The president's outline yesterday is a direct assault on the middle class and an expensive gift to the wealthiest Americans and the special interests.
We'll talk about the new tax plan and the rest of the week's news with our Week in Review team. Today, it's Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, it's great to see you again.
It's good to see you.
Also with us, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Tom, it's great to see you as well.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay, so how much do you both love President Trump's new tax plan? Jim?
I actually like quite a lot of it. Well, you know, I'm a small government guy,
yep,
and that makes, I think, a lot of sense. I think there are parts of it I don't like, and maybe it's more interesting to focus on that.
Okay.
Often it's said that the Republicans are deficit hawks. This cuts in a completely different direction. It shows that Republicans are just like Americans in that they don't like to pay for free lunches.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of free lunch in that tax plan.
I've seen that one estimate said it could add $4 trillion to the deficit in a decade.
There are some that say even up to 6.2. Now, this, to be fair, this is not a spending plan. But I think what you find is that Paul Ryan is going to have a very different view because he wanted to have something that was tax neutral,
mm-hmm,
to some degree.
Right.
So, you know, this is going to be an interesting one where the president's team, the Coneheads, you might call them, the Gary Coneheads,
yeah,
have really taken control of this agenda. It is definitely an agenda that's focused on growth. There's a lot of good in that, but they've set up a whole number of traps in that all the bad stuff that has to be done in the negotiation is going to have to come through the House.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, Tom, I mean, what do you make of this idea that this $4 to $6 trillion addition to the deficit we've heard over the course of this week, I mean, especially from the Treasury Secretary, that he says it's going to be all offset by massive amounts of growth.
Right, just 10% GDP growth a year, and I think we're all set, right?
So we just become China. China circa 2010.
So if you look at the first quarter GDP numbers, which were not very good in terms of growth, we got a long ways to go because our rate, I think, was at less than 1%,
mm-hmm,
annually. You know, what the Trump administration is saying is that you need at least 3% growth, and they argue that with 3% growth, somehow this becomes revenue neutral. Obviously, we haven't seen the numbers. And it's important to stress that basically what this tax plan is a one-page document, a series of bullets. It's almost impossible, really, to even analyze what,
right,
this is going to do.
Because it is literally one page right now.
Right. It's literally, yeah, one page. And there's things in here, for example, the 15% corporate tax rate, which is, I think, actually generally a great idea because our corporate tax rate is way too high compared to the rest of the world. But it also means that individuals are going to cleverly figure out a way to suddenly become corporations or LLCs themselves and therefore not be paying 25% or 30% or 35%, but rather 15%. So if that happens, then the impact on this in terms of the Treasury is dramatically greater.
Yeah. So let me just play some tape here because I've mentioned him a couple of times, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. Here he is at a press conference on Wednesday talking about all that growth we were mentioning earlier.
The economic plan under Trump will grow the economy and will create massive amounts of revenues, trillions of dollars in additional revenues.
On the other hand, on Wednesday, we also spoke with Richard Parker. He's a lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, definitely on the liberal side of the scale here. He says that the historical data don't show or don't support the basic theory behind supply-side economics. And he said that tax cuts haven't historically shown great amounts of growth.
Does this kind of tax policy, in fact, grow the economy dramatically better than other tax policies? We have a lot of data on that, and the answer is, I think, pretty conclusively no.
Jim, this is something we're going to be hearing a lot of in the coming weeks and months, and I just want to know what your take on this, what history shows us for these kind of tax plans.
Well, look, I think this is the problem. Tax doesn't drive everything. So one of the great things that happens with this plan that is also only on one page is that it cleans out a lot of the barnacles that have accumulated over 30 years and all the different tax giveaways and that sort of thing. It streamlines things enormously, and I think it makes it much more attractive to someone who's entering into the business creation business, if you will. But the history on this is checkered. I think if you take a look at the Reagan years, it was pretty good. But this has a lot in similar with the Bush tax cuts. There wasn't as much clean out of the barnacles that they're aiming for.
Right.
But it was on a 10-year window, just like this, because they have to go through a Senate reconciliation process. And the evidence from the Bush years is not very good. So if this is the only thing they're going to be doing, and this is how they're going to drive growth, I think the train's not going to move nearly as fast. And it's to Tom's point earlier, if they're aiming for 3 or even 3.5% growth, just tax policy, no way it's going to do it.
It's not going to do it enough. It's not going to be enough, at least. Yeah. So, Tom, let me just drive straight at what I think is at the heart of the long-running debate over taxes in the United States. The Trump plan, the one-page plan, as we know of it, says it's going to clean out all those barnacles, as Jim was talking about, getting rid of all those deductions.
And it looks like that.
Except for a couple of the most popular ones, mortgage and interest deduction, for example. It's also reducing the tax brackets down to 10, 15, and 35%. Yeah. And doing other things, eliminating the estate tax, for example. So there's a lot to dig into each one of those points, a lot to like, maybe a lot to not like. But overall, I think one of the big criticisms we're going to hear or are already hearing about the tax plan is that just like the Bush tax cuts, the consolidated effect is a tax cut for the wealthiest Americans, not much change for middle and middle class Americans. And therein lies the problem.
Right. So the tax rates are coming down. So that clearly is going to benefit those who are the wealthiest. The fact that you eliminate the estate tax or what is often called the death tax, I guess it depends upon what side of that aisle you're on. The fact that you're going to eliminate that plainly only at this point, that only affects the wealthiest of Americans as well. So Democrats are exactly right, which is to say that rich people are really going to benefit disproportionately. The big concern about the 10-year time frame here is that the way this is supposed to pay for itself is that business starts making these huge long-term investments. But you don't make long-term investments if it's only a 10-year. And remember, 1 year in, it's only a 9-year. So that's all you have. You have a very short time frame in terms of making those investments. The payback on them usually isn't that short. And as a consequence, you're not going to get the growth you wanted. So you have this plan that intends to pay for itself because of what I think is a good strategy with regard to corporate taxes. But it's really paying for the tax cuts for a lot on wealthy people.
Jim, last thought on taxes to you.
No, the only thing I'd say is for all of us who are here in Massachusetts listening to WBUR and talking at WBUR, for Massachusetts and California, New York, and other high-tax states, it's probably not a very good thing for even the upper middle class and the wealthy in the sense that the federal deduction for state taxes goes away as part of this, as one of the things they want to do to help defray the cost of it. So if you're in a low cost, low tax environment at the state level, it's great for you. For us, not nearly as good.
And remember what this is all about. Okay, doing away with this is a big shot right at the states that did not vote for Donald Trump. It is the urbanized states, California, New York, and Massachusetts, who are going to bear the brunt of this. States that voted for Donald Trump, which don't have any state income tax at all, feel no pain on this. Here, where we're paying state income taxes, effectively we will be paying a third more than we are right now.
Yeah. Well, much as I'm sure listeners would love us to talk tax policy for the entire week in review, let's move on and discuss another action that the Trump administration announced this week. On Wednesday, the president signed an executive order directing the Interior Department to review national monuments or the existence of national monuments larger than 100,000 acres and those specifically created since 1996. Here's the president.
The Antiquities Act does not give the federal government unlimited power to lock up millions of acres of land and water, and it's time we ended this abusive practice.
President basically calling the use of the Antiquities Act a land grab. Now, this order could really have an impact here in New England because we've got the first ever marine monument off our shores, the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument. That was created in 2016 by President Obama, and here he is announcing the marine monument.
We're protecting fragile ecosystems off the coast of New England, including pristine undersea canyons and seamounts. We're helping make the oceans more resilient to climate change, and this will help fishermen better understand the changes that are taking place that will affect their livelihood. And we're doing it in a way that respects the fishing industry's unique role in New England's economy and history.
That was President Obama in September of 2016. So, Jim, let me just start with you. I mean, obviously two very starkly different takes on the purposes of national monuments in America. What do you think of the review?
The review will be bottled up in court
for
quite some time. So this is one we're going to come back and talk about repeatedly. I mean, I think one of the things we've seen in the first 99 days of the Trump administration is that his own party has acted to some degree as a break. However you want to put that, the courts have certainly acted as a break. And in this case, they certainly will get involved. My own take on the one issue that's raised as regards Massachusetts, that's a marine monument, is, and I work with Gina McCarthy, have a lot of respect for her, full disclosure. I took her place at the state level. I afterwards work with her to some degree. I know this is sort of a Gina McCarthy special in the sense that I don't
Former EPA administrator.
Former EPA administrator. The fishermen and the communities that were most affected on the economic side were not sounded out in terms of what their opinions were on this, what it might do to them, I believe, sufficiently. I think there was a smart way to do this, and I hope that during the review there's a smart outcome which takes some of the good stuff that comes with the protection of that monument, but also facilitates a little bit of that industry, which is so important to the southeastern part of the state.
Yeah, the naming of this monument was quite controversial here in Massachusetts. But let me just, before I go to you, Tom, let me just play another piece of tape here, because we've got Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. He was at a press conference with the president on Wednesday, really speaking to this issue of what happens when the government names a new national monument.
Monument designations have placed public lands off limits for grazing, fishing, mining, multiple use, and even outdoor recreation. Somewhere along the way, the act has become a tool of political advocacy rather than public interest.
So, Tom, here's my question. I mean, the president is having a review of the monuments named since 1996. I think that's a nod to the fact that, given some time, most Americans like the monuments they've got once they realize that, hey, you know, it's been 5, 10, 15, 20 years, I don't know. We don't necessarily want a mountaintop to get blown up for mining because we like the fact that it's still preserved
it's still
in nature.
Yeah. Exactly, exactly. I think that's right. Americans really like this. On the other hand, if you go back and read the 1906 Antiquities Act, which I did.
And you have brought here with
and
you.
And I brought
in
it
fact.
With me. It's about as long as the tax plan. if you go back and look at it, you'll actually see that it really doesn't give the president that much authority. It really talks about when you protect lands it's really supposed to be very narrowly drawn to protect kind of antiquities and not millions and millions of acres, which it's been done for. So I understand the argument people are making, which is that presidents have basically used this and kind of, you know, driven a bus right through this thing and taken advantage of it. On the other hand, Jim's exactly right, that if you try to undo this at this point, the act appears to give whatever the president did doesn't seem like it can be undone by another president saying, no, right. I want to reverse course. It looks to me like it has to go through Congress, and that probably won't happen.
Mm. Well, I just want to play another piece of tape here because there's another New England national monument that's going to fall under this review, and that's the Mount Katahdin, or I should say the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument, 87,000 acres, and it was designated by President Obama. Maine Governor Paul LePage said this week that he plans to go to Washington next Monday to testify before Congress to have the monument's status revoked. Here's Governor LePage.
The legislature in Maine had a resolution that said they did not want a national park or monument. The governor weighed in, did not want it. We had local referendums that said they didn't want it, and he did it anyways. That's a violation of the Antiquities Act.
Jim, just your thoughts there.
I think it's going to be a long road for him as well. I mean, at the end of the day, they're going to have to sue even in that situation. I just don't see how they can win that.
Somehow the lawyers always win,
well,
right?
Particularly
no matter
this
what side. No matter what side.
One thing to consider is this, though. You can also modify the designation, and that's, I think, the direction they may want to go. And it looks to me like under the Antiquities Act, it's very possible to change it. So, for example, you might want to allow fishing where you're not allowing fishing,
yeah,
without doing away with the national park itself. That actually might happen. I suspect that's what we're going to see out of this review.
Mm. So says Tom Keene, who has brought the Antiquities Act with him. Never say that our Week in Review panelists are not well-researched here. All right, so let's actually move a lot closer to the center of town here and talk about what's going on regarding shadows, because on Wednesday, the Boston City Council voted 10-3 to approve a proposal that would allow construction of the Millennium Tower on the site of the Winthrop Square garage. Now, it's supposed to be 775 feet, so building the tower would violate current state laws that govern shadow on Boston Common and the Public Garden. Here's Councilor, City Councilor Tito Jackson, and mayoral candidate, I should say, who was one of the three councilors who voted no.
This is about the soul of the city of Boston and a question of, is the soul of the city of Boston, the future of the city of Boston, and how we leave it for our children for sale. And I will be voting no to emphatically say that is not for sale.
Councilor Sal LaMattina really hit back, saying the sale of the site for the tower brings a lot of needed revenue for the city.
Just to be serious, this is really good for the city. It's going to help people in my neighborhood that live in the most oppressive housing units in the city. I think that's a good thing. I'm not selling my soul. I will sell my soul if it's going to help poor families live in decent housing. Yes, I sold my soul.
Before we get to our discussion about this, if any members of the city council are hearing, we here at WBUR have some audio experts who could really help you with the audio of your live feeds. We appreciate that you're live feeding the council meetings, but help us out with this audio here. Okay, all right. Shadows on Boston Common because of the Millennium Tower. Jim, what's your take here?
My take is it's been really fun to read the Boston Globe because it's been a food fight over there, yeah, on all sides of the issue. And Dante Ramos's piece today, who's a columnist there, it's pretty severe. Ralph Waldo Emerson, he was actually talking about shadows when he came up with this quote. He said that a foolish consistency is a hobgoblin of little minds. He talks about how you focus on the shadow on the wall. In this case, I think that's kind of what I see in this issue. The serious part of this, there were multiple bidders. The amount of shadow that's going to be cast is limited. It's probably up to 90 minutes max per day, and it's usually in the morning, very early. What concerns me about it is this. This is one-time revenue, and will they apply it to one-time revenue type stuff like capital investments? What's the plan for using the money? And it feels to me a little too much like the mayor's office is responding and saying, we're going to try and build support by saying, we'll give a little to this, a little to that. It would be really wonderful to say, here's really what we want to do for all the parks in Boston. And this is the change it would make across the city, including also the Boston Common, which deserves some sort of mitigation. But what are we going to do for the rest of the city to make sure that people actually feel the effect, the benefit of this?
Good question. And by the way, you two are too polite. You ought to be correcting me here because there's so much development going on. I'm getting all the towers confused here. It is the Winthrop Square Tower. Yep. I called it the Millennium Tower on accident.
Well, it's because Millennium was the winning bidder.
Yeah, exactly. So, Tom, tell me, you love shadows? Shade.
Shade.
As Jim Sturgis is throwing a lot of shade about.
So I will tell you, I don't think anybody's soul was sold in this. I mean, it is really important for people who want to take a look at this issue to actually look at the graphics of what's going on. There are already, in the morning, shadows across the Boston Common and the Public Garden. This adds a little bit more shadow. Not a lot more shadow, a little bit more, and Jim's exactly right. It's not on every day of the year. In fact, most days of the year it doesn't happen, and it's only during the morning for a short amount of time. So it just strikes me the whole thing has been overblown. Getting to the money point, however, the big concern here, it seems to me, is that what you really have is a lot of money coming in for a guy who's running for mayor. And it is a great way to make sure you're going to get reelected as mayor, to have a lot of dollars to dole out to make sure people are really happy with you. And that's actually kind of a concern because you spend all this money and then a couple of years later you don't have the money in place to be able to, say, keep that refurbished park actually operating in a refurbished manner.
Jim, what do you think about that?
No, I think that's absolutely right. You could use this. One way you could use this, for example, is to set up a revolving fund of some kind that provides for the maintenance and upkeep of the parks well into the future, right? And it's a fund from which you draw the interest or something like that. But that kind of long-term thinking about what a one-time opportunity, so that people enter perpetuity, can actually say, that was actually a wonderful thing for the city. We made an exception for that. Otherwise, we're going to spend it. I mean, this is what we do, right? We spend money and we don't have much to look back for.
We'll spend it and then we're going to be looking for the next big hit out somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I want to play one more piece of tape. This is Liz Visa. She's the executive director of the Friends of the Public Garden, and she spoke to WBUR on Monday.
Approving this home rule petition sets a precedent and a blueprint for future projects. And the city can't guarantee that another developer with more money put on the table to entice the city would be open to exempting those laws for the future as well.
So, I mean,
yeah, this is the, you know, the camel's nose under the tent, that, oh, you, if you make one exception, then you'll always have to make exceptions. I just don't buy that. It's okay to make one exception and live with that. And it doesn't mean you're going to have to make another exception in the future.
Jim?
Look, if a developer came by and said, I'm going to give you $300 million next time for something that will put 30 minutes of shadow on the common.
You'd say sold.
I would say that's worth considering, but yeah.
Okay.
I don't think this has to go. Just remember, this doesn't have to just get approved by a city council. It has to go through the legislature.
Yes.
And the legislature is not going to willy-nilly just say exemption. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. It'd be amazing to see a flurry of great activity on Beacon Hill of some kind. That's me throwing shade. That's my shade for the day. All right. So we've got just enough time here for our hubbubs, and those are the stories that maybe didn't hit the top of the news, but we think deserve a little airtime anyway. So Tom, first to you.
Okay. Good news, everybody. UMass Boston just won the state's highest award for eco-friendly commuting. Of course, the reason so many people bike, walk, or use public transit to UMass Boston is because there's no parking on campus. The main campus garage is so dilapidated, it's unusable. It's kind of funny. We have this love-hate relationship with cars. We love ours, but we think others should use some other mode of transit. And you can see that in policies that try to reduce the use of cars. Sometimes those are inadvertent, as in the case of UMass Boston. Other times they're intentional, as is the case with new residential developments now built without parking at all. Personally, I'm a big fan of cars. Nothing else gives us the same degree of mobility and freedom. Plus, nothing else gives us the privacy to sing off-key at the top of our lungs. That eco-friendly award, it's not a sign of success, but rather a failure. UMass Boston is now in trouble with big deficits largely due to declining enrollment. Fix the garage, give people an easy way to get there, and the students will return. UMass Boston may end up a little less eco-friendly, but the institution itself will be thriving.
Oh, good hubbub, Tom. Okay, Jim, can you... Can you match that one?
Well, the only way to match is to go back 5,000 years. Kepler said that the universe, as of yesterday, was created.
I want you to note that you quoted both Emerson and Kepler on the show today.
Dude, there's more where that came from. So I actually want to focus on something different, which is yesterday's resumption of a tradition that would make Neapolitans proud and would provoke sharp disagreement from the craftsmen at the North Bennett Street School, and that is MIT students have brought back the musical equivalent of cow tipping, piano throwing.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to note that the piano fell flat, and the students decided to use the event for charitable purposes, and I hope it was a smashing success.
Very sharp of you. Piano throwing. Okay, so I went through this long spate of doing either wacky science or animal hubbubs, and now I'm back on the animal side of things because the Massachusetts State Police on their Facebook page very lovingly put up some photos of, you know, if you didn't read the caption, you'd say, why is a state trooper walking a llama down a highway? Well, apparently the troopers Matthew Kane and Kyle Minicucci, and I'm sorry if I said your name wrong, trooper, but they responded to a call this is from the Massachusetts State Police Facebook page, of a llama out on the lam, which they spelled L-A-M-B. But the troopers had some rope in their car. They managed to harness the llama and take it to safety. So well done, Massachusetts State Troopers, and good job with the puns on your Facebook page. Jim Sturgis and Tom Keene, thank you so much for joining us today. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Reports of anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. are up 86% so far this year. That's according to a recent study by the Anti-Defamation League. And with that increase comes a new wave of interest in a decades-old German law reinstating German citizenship to Holocaust refugees and their descendants. WBUR Shannon Dooling joined a small group of Jewish American citizens as they reclaimed their German citizenship in a ceremony at the German consulate in Boston.
I'm Larry Klein. I live in Newton, and my parents were German refugees from Nazi Germany.
59-year-old Larry Klein says his mother and father fled to the U.S. in 1939 and 1940, respectively. His grandparents on his father's side were killed in Germany during the Holocaust. His family's relationship with its German heritage has always been complicated.
It's kind of actually ironic and surprising to be doing this only because I grew up in a family where going to Germany was anathema, right? There's no way we'd ever visit Germany, and my grandmother wanted to teach us German as children, and my parents said, no, don't do that.
But Klein will be going to Germany, and he'll be doing so as a dual German citizen. The process Klein just completed is a constitutionally enshrined right established in post-World War II Germany. It allows for the restoration of citizenship that was illegally deprived to German Jews under Nazi rule. For many of those in the room, there's both a practical and symbolic motivation for restoring their German citizenship. For Klein and his wife, it means easier travel around Europe, and also a sort of plan B, something to keep in his back pocket amidst what he calls an increase in the acceptance of hate speech here in the U.S.
The tone of this country at this point in time is disturbing. A country like Germany, which, you know, has this history that obviously my family is well aware of, espouses the beliefs and philosophy that actually is the way I'd like a country to behave. So things come around in very interesting ways.
Klein says he's been thinking about starting the process for some time, but it wasn't until the November presidential election that he picked up the phone.
And so I called the consulate, and she said, yes, we have a program for that, and here's how you do it. And oh, by the way, you might imagine we've been very busy this week.
Although we don't have any firm statistical data on the reasons behind the application for naturalization, we have seen a considerable increase in applications since, well, the autumn or the end of last year.
That's Ralph Horlemann, the Consul General of Germany in Boston. He says in the first quarter of 2016, 13 people of Jewish origin reclaimed their German citizenship through the Boston Consulate. That number nearly quadrupled to 49 the first quarter of 2017. the numbers have increased so much at the Boston consulate that Horlaman decided instead of individuals coming to the office and picking up their paperwork, there will now be regular naturalization ceremonies. And so it is that in a meeting room at the German consulate office in Boston, 9 Jewish American citizens gathered around a conference table. Miniature flags representing Germany, the European Union, and the U.S. decorate the room, and there's champagne chilling in the corner. Horlaman addresses the group from a podium.
You have made a choice and a decision to apply for the restoration of German citizenship. For some of you, it may not have been an easy decision, given the reason why your families lost it in the first place, and also the legacy of the Holocaust.
The decision to reclaim German citizenship was years in the making for Linda Heumann of Providence, Rhode Island. Heumann's great-grandparents died in concentration camps, and her grandparents, dad and aunt, were all Holocaust refugees. Sensing a shift in the American political climate since the election of President Trump, she says the decision for her suddenly became clear.
I just instantly felt like I needed a someplace else to go. Just, I have that somewhere in my history, like that visceral knowledge with racism on the rise and anything might happen. So that was my motivation for finally getting around to filling out the paperwork.
And filling out the paperwork brought her on a journey she may not have otherwise experienced, learning about the orphanage her father and aunt lived in for a time and becoming closer to ancestors she never had the chance to meet.
I brought a picture with me today of my great-grandfather, and I thought, you know, the family lost everything when they left. They had stores, and I feel like today a like tiny piece of everything they lost is being restored.
Heumann says she plans to go back to Germany for a few months and to visit the place her family called home for generations.
That report from WBUR's Shannon Dooling. Back in a moment, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 2011, catastrophe struck Will Lautzenheiser. He was just 37 and looking forward to making a big move west to teach filmmaking at Montana State University. And as he was packing his things, Will felt a chill and a cramp in his leg. No big deal at first, but the pain in his leg did intensify. And just 10 days after arriving in Bozeman, Will was in the hospital. Every organ in his body was failing. A vicious infection was killing the tissues in his arms and legs. Incredibly, though, Will survived. But in order to save his life, doctors had to amputate both of his arms and legs. Well, this is where the new documentary Stumped begins. It follows Will as he recovers from this devastating illness through to another incredible moment in his life, a double arm transplant performed in 2014 at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Will Lautzenheiser and the director of Stumped, Robin Burgess, join us now. Welcome to both of you. And Will, actually, I just wonder if we could start with, oh man, what must have been one of the most difficult moments in your life. Could you tell us more of the story about what happened back in 2011 when you woke up in the hospital and discovered what had happened to you?
Well, it was incomprehensible in a way because not that many days before I found out what happened to me, I thought I was absolutely fine. And in fact, I went into the hospital and said to my friend, I'll see you at the noon meeting, Bob. And that turned out to be the last time I walked on my own 2 feet. And so I wasn't expecting to end up needing to be intubated, needing to be resuscitated 3 times due to total organ failure. And I had no idea what hit me. So when the tube finally came out, I was transported 2 states over and didn't know it because I'd been in a coma for a few days. And the nurses said, Mr. Lautzenheiser, do you know what state you're in? And I said, I'm in Montana. And they said, oh, looking at me very sadly, you're in Utah. I thought, I have no idea what's going on here. And it took a lot of explaining when someone finally said, you're really sick.
Yeah. So tell me more then about, as if that wasn't enough, right? That when you found out the true extent of what being really sick meant.
It was incomprehensible to think that when I finally saw my limbs, they were black, they were necrotic, there were horrible wounds on them, and there was nothing to do about it. Necrosis would spread if it weren't cut out. That's the state of treatment right now. And so I had to make a choice to amputate all four of my limbs, and there was really, in a way, no option. So it was scary. It was nightmarish, surreal. And I just kept thinking, I'm going to wake up from this and it's going to be different. Mm-hmm. And it was difficult to come to the realization that it wasn't a bad dream.
Yeah. Well, we actually have a clip of you from the film talking about what happened. This is when you're at Improv Boston, though. So we're going to talk about Improv Boston here in a second, but I just want to play it again. This is from the documentary Stumped.
What really happened to me is I got toxic shock syndrome from a group A strep infection that went haywire and basically killed my limbs. And, you know, that's not really funny. But I always thought before all of this happened that toxic shock syndrome was something you could basically only get from wearing certain tampons. That's not how I got it. And
So before listeners get mad about how tone deaf it might sound to hear laughter in this conversation, because we are talking about something so serious, I mean, that was you, Will, at Improv Boston. Can you tell us about doing stand-up around what happened to you?
Humor is just such a great healing mechanism, and it's also a way to kind of break down barriers. And so first, when I was in the hospital, you know, maybe my natural inclination is to make jokes, or I kind of have a kind of gallows humor personality anyway. Maybe this is the apotheosis of that. So my nurses and my other caregivers were able to make jokes with me too. And I think that really helped my healing process. It helped me stay sane.
Yeah.
So later on, after I got out of the hospital and I was working on the movie with Robin, we both realized that we wanted to present the story in a public fashion. And it was actually Robin's suggestion to say, you know, you're pretty funny about this. Why don't you do it at a stand-up show? And I thought there was absolutely no way that that was going to happen. So I said, sure, let's do it. Little did I know she had connections, and it was only a couple days later that we had the show booked.
Wow.
So that was how that happened.
Well, Robin, why don't you tell us, how did you and Will first meet?
Yeah, so I was working for Boston University as a video producer, and someone from the College of Communication told me what had happened to Will and asked me if I could work on a news piece about him. And from there, it evolved into a short documentary. I really connected well with Will, and I was getting ready to move to Texas, and that's when I asked him if I could continue working on a story with him. And then when the Brigham and Women's Hospital approved Will for arm transplant surgery, I approached the hospital and asked them if I could continue chronicling his story with their team. And they were great and gave us full access.
Right. Because, I mean, that's one of the great things about the film, right? Because it brings together the remarkable story of Will and your will and survival and spirit and the medical science behind the double arm transplant. So I mean, tell me, like, when did you first find out that you could be eligible for the transplant?
Well, I first found out about the possibility of arm transplants in the first place when I was still in the ICU in Utah in late 2011, because the Brigham had successfully completed their first double arm transplant with the patient Richard Mancino. And I received articles about it, and I thought there was absolutely no way I was ever going to be connected with that team. But once I came back to Boston, it turned out that through a series of connections, I was able to meet the transplant team. And at the time, I was so ill that it seemed like a remote possibility still. But they said, why don't you heal a little bit and come back in maybe a year and we'll reconsider. And I gained weight back and I gained strength. And when we started talking about it almost a year later, it seemed like maybe it would be a good possibility.
Well, we actually have another clip from the film. This is of your twin brother, Tom, and about his point of view before the double arm transplant surgery.
You know, Will would ideally and ultimately benefit from this, but it's also a huge sacrifice on his part to essentially put himself on the altar, you know, of science and medicine, and say, okay, I'm willing to risk it all for this.
Yeah, because there's no guarantees. There were no guarantees, right? I mean,
no.
Did you feel that way about putting yourself at risk on the altar of science?
I thought that I would be angry with myself for the rest of my life if I didn't try it once I found out that it was actually a possibility. So I was ready to go for it. And I thought it was worth the risks.
Yeah. So Robin, what was it like for you, you know, watching and documenting this part of the process? Because there's so much uncertainty and so much waiting.
I think that's the hard part about documentary filmmaking. And in this project in particular, we filmed over 4 years because it was Will's life unfolding. And that physical and spiritual transformation was used as a narrative structure, so it took time. So that's certainly a challenge, and you have to roll with real life, you know, when different things happen that are unexpected. But I think for me, it was really remarkable to see him get better over time. And then it was hard, too, to realize that, you know, he was risking a lot after he had healed to then go through this procedure.
Yeah. So Will, tell me more about after you had the surgery, because we talked about the realization right after you got sick when you came to and they were asking you about, do you understand the state that you're in? Here we have the other end of that, where you had a double arm transplant surgery. What was it like, you know, in the first hours and days after that step in your life?
It was incredible. I looked at the arms. I said, I think these are the most beautiful hands I've ever seen. I was so moved. The emotion is almost indescribable because it felt like, even though we'd planned it for so long, that the restoration was so unbelievable. And even though I still don't have my legs, it's, you know, the possibility of touching something again just seemed... it's really happening. It's really happening. You know,
yeah.
It was dazzling. I was floating on a cloud in a way.
Yeah. Do you mind if I ask some sort of just basic physiological questions about how your arms work now? How much sense or feeling do you touch feeling do you have?
I have quite a bit of touch feeling. It's not 100%. It feels a little funky, a little muted. Things are somewhat slower than they might have used to be, but it slowly gets better. So at first I had no sensation at all in the hands, of course, because we were waiting for the nerves to grow down. And if they grow a millimeter a day, that meant, you know, after a month, I only had 3 centimeters of feeling in my arm. And then slowly it's come down, and so I now have feeling throughout my hand, and it goes down to my fingertips.
Wow. Just that fact that the nerves do grow down into the arms, just that simple fact is remarkable.
It is. It's in and of absolutely itself. Amazing to think that the body can have that power of restoration.
Yeah. And so you have feeling all the way down to your fingers.
Correct.
And how much strength and agility do you have with your hands?
I have fairly acceptable broad motor control, but I will never have fine motor control of my fingers. So I can't button a button yet. It's easy to grab an object and pull it to me.
Is it okay if I tell listeners that you put on the headset, the headphones that you're wearing here in the studio? Can I say that? Because it was awesome to watch you do that.
Sure.
Well, the only reason why I want to mention is that first of all, you did it. And it's one of those things that most of us will never think about how significant it is that our hands can actually pick up a pair of headphones and stick them on our heads. But you said it was the first time you've been able to do that.
I surprised myself. Yeah, it was dazzling. Very happy.
So can I just want to ask you, this is a question I know that you've had before, but because in the film you talk about how your arms are yours, but they're also your donors at the same time.
Just correct.
Tell me more about that.
Well, in the movie I use the Joycean word, his my, that's James Joyce. And I, in a way, still think of them that way because one couldn't possibly be more intimately connected to someone than to have a donor relationship. It's the most incredible and moving gift imaginable. So I use my arms as mine, but my donor is never far from my mind.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the film, Robin, there's a scene from a press conference at the Brigham, and the family of the donor says that he gave the best hugs. Yeah, I mean, what was it like? You were the one of the primary witnesses to this journey. I mean, tell me how you were feeling as you watched, you know, Will get the surgery, and every day making progress after that.
Well, it's just remarkable to see how much he was able to regain, you know, and I think that, you know, from the scientific perspective, it blows my mind that it's possible. And also from, you know, just day in and day out, the things that we take for granted, being able to do those again now with hands is pretty awesome.
Will, how much farther do you want to go in terms of regaining the life that you had before you got sick? Because I haven't even mentioned you played the violin.
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting question because my life has changed a lot, obviously.
Yeah.
Not just in what I've sort of lost the ability to do, but as I'm beginning to make more strides to get out of sort of the rehab mode and try to get back into things, I would like to teach again, and I'm working on a short film. So those are the things that were priorities to me, and it would be really nice to, you know, complete it.
Yeah. You're free to say that that's actually the wrong question that I asked.
No, it's a great question because things have changed so much that it has, in a lot of ways, reframed some of my life goals.
Right.
And I have a better sense now of what things are important to me and what things are inessential.
Yeah. Now, do you mind if I ask, is there a possibility of leg transplants?
There is a possibility of further transplantation, yes. It's something that I'm exploring with the doctors. I haven't said no, and neither have they, would probably be the best way to put it. I've undergone a considerable amount of testing that would be required for it, and so far there's no clinical reason sort of not to. But there are a lot of unknowns about it, especially with the immune system, and how potentially another transplant would even interfere or interact with the first transplant.
Right.
So if the legs were to endanger my arms, that would be a horrible, horrible situation. I think I'll have to make some mental adjustments to prepare for another couple of years of rehab if I eventually decide to do it. Mm-hmm. So there are some days I think I'd be absolutely crazy to do it, and there are other days when I think this would be incredible to walk on my own 2 feet again, in a way, my own 2 feet.
Well, the documentary is called Stumped, and Will Lautzenheiser, who received a double arm transplant in 2014. Will, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Robin Burgess, director of Stumped, thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you, Meghna.
Also, by the way, hats off to the incredible transplant team at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Stumped was the opening night film on Wednesday at the Boston Independent Film Festival. The festival runs through May 3rd, and you can find a lot more information about Stumped, the documentary, and the festival at our website, RadioBoston.org. And I've got just enough time today to say thank you to the best production team in radio, Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, Allison Bruzek. We also had help today from Sean Bowden and Caitlin Elizabeth O'Keefe. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Have a sublime weekend. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.